Behind the Bite podcast is part of a network of podcasts that are good for the world. Check out podcasts like the Full of Shit podcast, After the First Marriage podcast, and Eating Recovery Academy over at practiceofthepractice.com/network. Welcome to Behind the Bite podcast. This podcast is about the real life struggles women face with food, body image, and weight. We're here to help heal, inspire, and create better, healthier lives. Welcome. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to today's show. I'm excited to bring on our guest today. I'm not going to do much to say other than if you are a clinician or you are somebody who just has a lot of questions about food and diet, just maybe even somebody who for years has been off and on diets and just has a lot of questions about, you know, what that is all about and really wants to get off of that roller coaster, or just honestly anybody. I think this is a very educational show, and my guest here today has a lot to say. She is an expert in the field of eating disorders. She does a lot to educate not only therapists, but just people in general about eating disorders. And so that being said, I'm going to tell you who this guest is, and then we're going to get right into the discussion. Believe me, you're not going to want to miss a word of what she says. So if you are not in a place where you can sit back and listen to anything she says, I want you to hit pause and then come back when you are able to really have the time and space to listen. Judith Matz is a therapist, a nationally recognized speaker and consultant on the topics of diet culture, binge eating, emotional eating, body image, and weight stigma. She is co-author of The New Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, as well as The Diet Survivor's Handbook, Beyond the Shadow of a Diet, The Making Peace with Food card deck, The Body Positivity card deck, and author of Amanda's Big Dream. Judith offers continuing education and training for professionals through PESI, as well as customized presentations for a variety of companies and organizations. Judith's work has been featured in the media, including NPR, The New York Times, Good Housekeeping, and Psychotherapy Networker. She has a private practice via telehealth in Illinois, where she meets with clients seeking to heal their relationship with food and their bodies. All right. Well, Judith, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here today.
Well, I'm glad you're here. And you know, for people who don't know who you are, would you mind sharing a little bit about how you got to this place in your career and in your life?
Oh, I'd be glad to. Well, first of all, I'm a clinical social worker, so I'm a therapist. I have a private practice in the Chicago area, but I have been working in the non-diet field actually since the early 1990s. So I worked in a mental health center for about 4 years after I had gotten my master's in social work. And then I decided to do some postgraduate work at a well-known training hospital in my area. And the thing that interested me most was eating disorders. So I started studying eating disorders. At that time, it was anorexia and bulimia. Binge eating disorder wasn't yet a diagnosis. This is in the 1980s, actually. And when I was there, I needed to earn some money. And so I started a very small private practice, but I also got a job with the OptiFast program. So do you remember that? Remember Oprah carrying her wagon across the stage with the amount of fat she lost? So this is for anybody who's not familiar with it, this was a medically supervised weight loss program where people for the first 3 months did nothing but drink these terrible tasting shakes. And the second 3 months, they were slowly reintroduced to food. And during this process, they came to a weekly support group that was led by a therapist, which was me, and by a dietitian. And we had a manual and they were learning everything about nutrition as if they didn't know it already. They had read all the books usually, but, and they were learning behaviors, you know, like not to eat in front of the TV and things like that. And so the idea was that by the time food was reintroduced, they would have all these new behaviors in place, and the weight would stay off. Well, we all know how that story ended, just like with all diets, with all plans. For the vast majority, the weight came back. Mm-hmm. But at the time I was leaving, I was having my first baby, and I was leaving the program, and some of the people who had been in my group asked me if I would continue to work with them in my private practice. After they finished the 6-month program, mm-hmm. They could enter what was called a maintenance group to continue to get support for what was the plan of the day was low fat eating and exercise. Mm-hmm. And so I agreed to it, and I would meet with them once a week in my group. And what I witnessed is that they were successful by society standards at the time, in that they were keeping the weight off. But in order to do so, they were obsessed with food. They had to write down everything they ate. If they went to a gathering and there were foods they hadn't planned for, they were in a panic. They were anxious. Some were over-exercising. And it hit me, like, if this is what I'm helping people do, to do, stay this obsessed and preoccupied with food and weight, I don't think I want to have any part in this. And around that time, I read the book Overcoming Overeating. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like one of the first non-diet, what we call anti-diet books. Then we use the term non-diet books by Jane Hirschman and Carol Munter, who were two New York therapists. And they were talking about how it was the deprivation of dieting that was one of the major factors in seeing the binging or the, you know, eating to discomfort that people were experiencing. And when I read that book, not only did it make sense to me in terms of what I was seeing with this group, but it fit my own personal history, which was that in high school, I started to diet because that's what girls did. I was afraid of getting fat and people would pass around these diets. And so I started, and as the result of the deprivation I saw eventually, I started to binge for the first time. And it followed me through college. It followed me through grad school. It followed me after grad school. I went to, I'm from the Chicago area, and I knew I'd be settling back here, but I went to Boston for a summer. And at that point, I was just really tired of dieting. I didn't have a scale or mirror. It was the summer. I got a job at a well-known seafood restaurant in Boston. Food was available. And I just thought, forget it. I don't want to deal with this for the summer. I'll start my diet again when I get back in the fall. And when I returned to Chicago in the fall, I realized I wasn't binging anymore. Once I was allowed to eat foods I enjoyed, I resumed what had actually been a very peaceful relationship with food growing up. I didn't have my parents never dieted. We were fortunate that food was plentiful. And so I ate in an attuned way growing up. And the dieting is what kind of really just messed me up in my relationship with food for a while. So after I read that book, I was like, oh, I do like working in this field of eating disorders, but I'm moving away from dieting. And, you know, I would see people in my practice who would come to me who had had really good therapy in the past, but this was the one issue they hadn't been able to heal because, you know, their therapists were encouraging dieting. Dieting is often seen in our culture as self-care. Mm-hmm. So that's how I came to do this work.
Okay. Yeah. And that's so interesting. As you're talking about all of this, right, I worked in a hospital and they promoted the OptiFast program too. And they had the same thing and it was the same experience. So as you're talking, people can't see me, but I'm nodding going, yes, yes, yes. And that's such a common experience for many people.
Yeah. And not only that, but you know, what happens is that because all of these programs work initially, right? Mm-hmm. When they fail, it's the person is blamed. The dieter is blamed. Right. You didn't have enough willpower. You didn't follow the program correctly, which is just unfair because the problem, it's, you know, what we say is you haven't failed your diet failed you. The problem's in the solution, but because it works in the short term, it's kind of confusing. Like, well, it worked before, so I must be doing something wrong now. It's really important people understand that just about any program or plan out there will work initially. And when it doesn't work anymore, it's because there are strong psychological and physiological forces that compel you to go to the food.
Well, you brought something up too, is like what they're doing for all of these weeks is essentially starving themselves. They're not eating enough. There's that deprivation. And so when you're saying it's working, it's like, what exactly is working, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Because in diet culture, working means I'm losing weight. Mm-hmm. And And I think then the confusion is that people assume, well, this is what's supposed to be happening. Like you're saying, Christina, the under-eating is considered normal. Mm-hmm. And so then when the binging or the out-of-control eating occurs, people see that as the failure, but it's just the flip side of the same coin, the under-eating and then the eating to discomfort. Because you, like you're saying, it's actually a victory in evolution that bodies, when they're starving, find food in times of famine, that we go to the food. That's supposed to happen.
Right. So I'm curious, like when people would come see you for the quote unquote maintenance phase, when they started to inevitably like eat again and gain the weight, did they have this urge? I heard this all the time in my practice, like, I want to go back and diet again. I want to go back. You know, there's that urge to do that because they felt like, oh gosh, like I'm feeling so bad about myself. I, you know, people are looking at me like, what did you do wrong? Like they're embarrassed to see people.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. Like that's the cycle. Like the cycle is there's something wrong with me, whether I'm not healthy enough or my stomach sticks out or my thighs rub together. So people go on the diet, right? Mm-hmm. By diet, it can be any kind of restriction. It doesn't have to be a formal diet or it might be cutting out carbs, whatever it is. Like, and then they experience the deprivation. They may not be aware of it, but their body is physically deprived. Psychologically, we want what we can't have. And then they go to the food, right? The rebound effect is to go to the food or they have the binge. And then what I think is the most insidious part of the whole cycle is what you're talking about, the shame people feel. Mm-hmm. Because here I was supposed to, you know, I'm told that I don't have the right kind of body, right? It's not acceptable. So I do what society tells me. I go on a diet and then I fail at that. And then, so then that shame leads to the next round of dieting. And this can go on for years. Often I work with clients where this has gone on for decades. Mm-hmm. But what you asked me about in my maintenance group, see, it was during my maintenance group, I read the book, Overcoming Overeating. And so I basically said to the group, I'm shifting the way I work. And so a couple of people actually hung in there with me and when I started a non-diet group.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious now, so like, at what point did you, obviously you've written some books and, you know, because you read that book, but you were getting to the point where you were able to write your own books. How did that happen? How did you get to the point where you had enough experience where you were saying, okay, now it's time for me to impart some information and write books myself?
Yeah. Thanks for asking me about that. So what happened is that I would be seeing clients. And like I said earlier, they had really good therapy before, mm-hmm. but the one place that they just weren't making any progress. And I came to understand that like me, so many therapists, well, first of all, I was trained as a psychodynamic therapist. So I was trained that if we could just understand the reasons why somebody was going to the food, why somebody was binging, the underlying dynamics, that would resolve it, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember my first client at the mental health center before I had any eating disorder training, working with her that way, and she made tremendous progress in terms of her self-esteem, in terms of identifying a career path, in terms of relationships, but her eating didn't change. And it wasn't until I learned about a non-diet approach that I was actually able to refer her to a group that used that model, and she was able to make peace with food. And so I realized that as therapists, as clinicians, we don't get any training in this. And I still think all these years later, it's still true. People might get a little bit on eating disorders, but really not much on like chronic dieting, you know, on what's normative culture. And so I wanted there to be a resource for therapists out there. And the first book I wrote is called Beyond the Shadow of a Diet. And my co-author is Ellen Frankel, who is also a social worker specializing in eating disorders. And she's also my sister. And so we had the best time working together. In fact, I send out a quarterly newsletter and I was just finishing it up and we were going over how this happened today. We were standing in my parents' kitchen. I was asking her, who was it that came up with the title? I think it was her. Mm-hmm. I knew I wanted to write the book. She had this title and she had a little more time than I did. And we decided we would just collaborate and do it together. And that was awesome. That is- and so this became really, I think, the first book for professionals on how to treat what we now call binge eating disorder. In 2004, it wasn't called an eating disorder yet, but we talked about, then the term used the most was compulsive eating. Mm-hmm. Talked about, compulsive eating and emotional eating. And the roots of that book are still very applicable. So I was telling you before we started this that our third edition, so in 2004 was the first edition, 2014 was the second edition. And right around the day this podcast is going to be released, I think on May 20th, our third edition comes out. And I'm really excited about it because, you know, over time, there's been so much more research to validate all of this. So mm-hmm. we're able to add the research, but also it's just a much more inclusive book. As our culture has changed, we've, you know, taken out some of the things that we no longer feel as comfortable with and been able to really build on our original mm-hmm. book. But that became the book that not only mental health professionals were using, but they would use it with their clients because there wasn't really much out there. And it's written, it's easy to read. We give a lot of like client stories. So not just therapists use it. And then a couple of years later, we wanted to have a book really meant for the general public. And we wrote the Diet Survivor's Handbook. So I don't know if you've taken a look at that, but it had lessons and activities. Since that time, I've done a lot of training of mental health practitioners because, you know, all of us have grown up in diet culture. Right. We've all learned these messages. About what's valued around body size, that the belief in diet culture that thin is better than fat, mm-hmm. that limiting foods is the way to get the weight you want, that if you just eat the right way, you'll be healthy and live forever. Feels like what the message is, you know, more about wellness culture. And it's really been wonderful to get to do these trainings around the country. Mm-hmm. And ask therapists to reflect on their own attitudes. I do a thing where I show a picture of someone thinner and someone fatter and ask them to just brainstorm adjectives connected to each. And very quickly, people realize the stereotypes they have.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, for having so much of my work is really dedicated to not only working with clients to make peace with food, but the reach is bigger when other therapists can begin to unlearn their own implicit biases mm-hmm. and work with clients of all sizes. Yeah.
And I agree with you completely. I'm wondering too, like, do you get any medical doctors that come to your trainings? Because I feel like there is a lack of training in medical school on eating disorders too. And it's, to me, I just don't understand that because it's not just an illness that affects the mind. It also affects the body. And so I'm just wondering if you also get medical doctors in there.
I agree with you. What you're talking about is such a big frustration. I don't, because the company I speak for gives continuing education and they don't give it for doctors.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Occasionally I get nurses.
Okay.
And dietitians. But there certainly are colleagues of mine out there doing work trying to reach doctors. And there's actually, I'm sorry, I'm not going to remember their name exactly, but in June, I presented at there was an annual weight stigma conference, an international conference that was in Denver this past June. And there was this group of medical students who have formed an organization and they're doing wonderful work. I can send you that link.
That's fantastic, actually.
It's nice to know there is somebody out. These are young students. And I, you know, that's something I really value, when I can get younger people mm-hmm. to my trainings so they don't have to spend so much time unlearning what they've learned, right? Mm-hmm. So, with Beyond a Shadow of a Diet, I know there are some college professors, instructors who use it in their courses. So people learning that early is awesome. And so that would be the same, you know, in the medical community, to have people learning that in medical school would be great, because I agree, it's really lacking. Mm-hmm.
So if there's a clinician, you know, listening today to the podcast, because we do get clinicians listening, and they're thinking, well, you know, in grad school, I got some information on eating disorders. I know the diagnostic criteria. Like, why would I need to read your book? What's different?
Okay, that's a great question. So I guess I want to talk a little bit about emotional, what we call emotional eating. Because I think that a lot of therapists would say, well, no, I don't specialize in eating disorder, but I do work with emotions all the time. And oh, yes, I have somebody turning to food when they're upset. So like I said earlier, I think the way a lot of people work is I'm going to either teach them behaviors. There's, you know, some books out about like cognitive behavioral work with people who, quote, want to lose weight, or we're just going to work on the emotions and the symptom will diminish or disappear. I think it's really important for, first of all, therapists to unpack their own weight bias, the idea that everybody needs to lose weight and understand weight regulation. And that's beyond what I'll talk about now. But there's a reason we all come in different shapes and sizes. And so at the very least, understanding that the more people diet, the higher their weights are over time, just because the body gets better at storing fat. And so what we really want to focus on with our clients is what is true self-care? How can we help our clients who want to? It's not a moral issue, but how do we help people take care of themselves? What do they define as self-care? So for some people, it's getting better sleep or finding better ways to manage stress or, you know, being physically active. And doing those things because they support physical and emotional well-being, not as a weight loss method. That's really key. So when clients talk about emotional eating, I'm an emotional eater. People say that a lot. I like to remind therapists that eating is an emotional experience, right? I mean, we have food present in all kinds of emotional events, at graduations. I'm thinking of all the graduations coming up this spring. But we have them at weddings. We have food at weddings. We have it at funerals. It's a way it can connect us to our friends, our family, our history, our culture. There's nothing wrong with that. And it's also normal to, you know, I'm bored, I eat something, or I have a particularly stressful day, I might go to something. In and of itself, that's not the biggest deal. When I think about emotional eating, I'm talking about people who rely on food as a primary way to manage stress. So when you have a therapist saying, oh, well, I know all the criteria for an eating disorder, what I really like people, therapists, but also my clients to understand. So for anybody listening who's not a therapist, this is relevant too. How do you know when you turn to food if it's because something emotional is going on or because you've restricted that food? So if you're somebody who says, I can't eat sweets or I shouldn't eat them, they're fattening, and then you find yourself binging on sweets or eating them in a way that feels out of control, how do you know it's because it's you're upset with your partner and not because the deprivation just finally got to you? So I think it's really important to help for therapists to learn how, so they can work with their clients about how to end deprivation-driven eating, how to begin to identify physical hunger, how to figure out when you're hungry, like what will truly nourish your body, what will feel best in your body, what will not only taste good, but leaving you feeling satisfied. Because so often when people are restricting food, they don't feel satisfied. They either might still feel hungry, or often they feel full, but something's missing, right? And so then they keep eating to try to fill that. And so I do a lot of work with people on what I call making the match, figuring out in the moment what kind of food will really give you that hit the spot feeling. And it's so interesting when I work with people who've even been through programs like eating disorder programs, they leave with meal plans and nobody's ever asked them, and they've never asked themselves, what would actually feel good in my body right now? So they're still stuck with this, I'm supposed to eat this. If it doesn't satisfy you, you're just not going to feel the same. You're not going to get that sense of physical and emotional well-being. So as people begin to increase decrease the amount of deprivation driven eating and increase the attuned eating experiences, just by definition, that the out of control eating is reduced. And then that leaves them better able to identify what is actually I'm reaching for food and I'm not hungry, something must be bothering me right now that I need to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. From there, I like to help people figure out or learn about what I call how they make the translation from the language of feelings into the language of food and weight. Because so often what people say is, you know, or what people describe is they find themselves, say, binging on potato chips. And what happens? Oh, there I go again. I'm out of control, right?
Right.
I better do something about it. I better, you know, get them out of the house, go on a diet. As if going on a diet to lose weight will solve the real problem, which is they were feeling distress, emotional distress. So they've made a translation from the language of feelings to the language of food and weight. Does that, did you follow that?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. So being able to say then, well, first of all, what I think is really helpful, you know, I'm reaching for food. Am I hungry? And if the answer is yes, even if something emotional is going on, I need to eat.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reaching for food. Am I hungry? No. Can I wait? The answer is no. It's okay to go to the food. This working your way out of emotional eating is never about control. Dieting is about control. You're in control or out of control. This is about over time learning new strategies. And so I'm reaching for food. I'm not hungry. Can I wait? No. Okay. I need to eat. I look forward to the day I no longer need to do this. Curiosity and compassion are key here. Mm-hmm. So that over time, as my clients say, have ended the deprivation. I'm thinking of one person. I wrote about her in our last newsletter, which is called the Diet Survivors Group newsletter, by the way, and it's on my website if anybody's interested. But I tell a story. This is a woman in her 70s who's binged for decades and never thought she'd be able to stop. But she did. And she had a day where she all of a sudden was binging in a way that was unfamiliar over the past months. And she was surprised. She didn't know what was happening. And so as we talked about it, like, what would she have thought about or felt if she hadn't reached for food in that moment? She recalled that she was scrolling through Facebook and she saw some of her friends, groups of friends, had been out to dinner and they hadn't invited her.
Oh.
She felt some distress about it.
Mm-hmm.
So she was able to identify what it was that was bothering her. But that's the really neat thing about this work, that as people end the deprivation, you know, it's like the food doesn't, if the cookies no longer, you know, if I'm somebody who's binged on cookies and sweets, but now I've made peace with them, I don't restrict them anymore, I've habituated to them, I've reintegrated them in my life, and I'm going to reach for them, they may not even glitter like they used to. They may not take me away from what I'm feeling in the same way that they used to.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes with people, so with the one example I gave you, she had a day where she did go to the food, but she was able to slow down and ask what it was. And to me, that's a victory in terms of it became an opportunity for her to learn something about herself. Other people will say, I went to the food and it just didn't do anything. And I'll call that the good news and the bad news. Right? I mean, the good news is, yeah, you're not going to the food. The bad news is you're left with whatever really, really bothering you. But in the end, we know that's actually good news.
Mm-hmm.
You learn what the food moved you away from. So it's complicated. So just reading about diagnoses doesn't teach mm-hmm. you.
No, and it's interesting, right? So like I'm a psychologist, eating disorder specialist, but you know, my own journey too, right? Everything you're saying going, yes, 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 right? Like I can too read the diagnostic criteria and it is not anything like the lived experience at all. It's just the diagnostic criteria. It does not talk about any of the things that you're just explaining right here, right?
So when you asked about books I've written, the most recent one that came out is a workbook that I love to tell you about. It's called, I'll give you the whole title and it is a mouthful. The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, a Trauma-Informed Weight-Inclusive Approach to Make Peace with Food and Reduce Body Shame. But we wanted to how comprehensive it is.
Yeah.
The thing I'm thinking of it right now is that even though we wrote it for people who are struggling with chronic, with all of those things in the
right.
Each chapter has a section called the Clinician's Corner, and it guides therapists. So even therapists who are not eating disorder specialists, there's a section at the end of each chapter to tell them what to be thinking about and how to integrate it into their work, so that they can actually use it with clients. So we're excited about having that part, having a resource that could speak to both people struggling with it and therapists or dietitians or whatever kinds of clinicians.
Now, I think that's fantastic. I applaud you for doing that. I sometimes, I know not everyone's a specialist, and I know not everyone gets the nuances of eating disorders or what it's like for someone who has one. But I do think it is confusing being seeped in toxic diet culture, because it's so hard to not, if you, especially doing what you do, is like having people check their own weight biases. I think there is still a lot of confusion and misinformation. Just people thinking, oh, you can look at somebody, know if they have an eating disorder or which one at that, right? Like many people still believe, oh, if someone has an eating disorder, they, if they have anorexia nervosa, they must be in a very thin emaciated body. And that's just not true. Or,
and if, and if they're a higher weight body, they must have binge eating disorder.
Exactly.
Yeah. So many myths out there. You're absolutely right about that. You know, it's interesting too. I don't remember. I mentioned it before we got on the call that I do these PASI trainings through PASI. And I guess I would say that when I've done them live since the pandemic, I do them more as webinars online. But when I ask people one thing they hope to, when I did them live, one thing you hope to get out of being here today, so many would name that they struggle with this themselves. So they were here both professionally and personally. And I applaud people for being honest about that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, let's face it, if somebody's entrenched in diet culture themselves as a therapist, I have great compassion for how they got there, because again, we're all part of this culture. Mm-hmm. And in order to treat people in a trauma-informed way, it is essential that they do their own work. So I'm thrilled when they come to my, many have gone on to consult with me or become, you know, if they live in the Illinois area, to become my clients, I've gotten, you know, who've come to my initial. So we're, in that sense, we're all in this together. And it's just so important that we keep, I mean, that's why I love that you do this podcast, because these create the ripple. So whether it's through my books or your podcast, we're creating ripples, right? To try to take down diet culture. I mean, that's the root of so much of this. Like, what if we truly believed bodies came in all shapes and sizes?
Right.
What would be the reason for these, you know, the pursuit of weight loss? It just would go away. I know that's magical thinking. I wish it were.
But why can't we think that? That's what I don't understand. Why is that not the prevalent mindset?
Well, because first of all, ideas around attractiveness are so subjective. Other cultures at different times and places, it's been a larger body,
right?
And, you know, desired. And as people have looked at this and analyzed this, and I'm sure you've had other guests on the show talk about it, we're understanding some of the racist beginnings of those tie in. But I think in general, for people, like for clients I get, what they're coming in with is, I can't be healthy unless I lose weight. You know, well, Judith, that's just a fact. Like, yeah, you know, it's all nice to say body positivity, but how could I possibly be healthy? Mm-hmm. And they're not familiar with the research out there that shows that practicing certain behaviors actually mitigates risk associated with higher weights. Mm-hmm. And so that was really important too. Like, the workbook follows, in large part, the training I do, because it just starts at the very beginning with our story. You know, we all have a story, and then work your way through the deprivation of dieting, emotional eating. Mm-hmm. Amy Pershing, who co-authored, works a lot with trauma and binge eating. And then we have a lot of body image and a lot. And then we have a whole section devoted to health and how to work on physical health without a focus on weight loss. And then Christy Harrison, my other co-author, does a beautiful job talking about nutrition as an attuned eater. And we always save that for the very end because we don't want anybody to try to develop rules. But we talk about how you can, you know, we're not saying anything goes here. Just do it. You know, you can eat anything and everything. We're saying connect your eating to your body. And if it supports your body to add fiber, terrific. We can think about how to do that.
Mm. Yeah, I love that you're not rule-based, because I think there's, even with intuitive eating, I hear this all of the time. People are constantly saying, well, there's rules to that, or I'm not doing it right. And it's, you know, I think there's just this, I don't know if it's a drive or a need for people to just have some kind of rules or template, or they want to know how to do things the right way versus the wrong way.
It's interesting what you're bringing up, because in one way, like, people who are so used to having an external structure or rules can turn, I tend to use the term attuned eating instead of intuitive eating, but basically I'm talking about the same thing, mm-hmm. turn it into like what we sometimes call the stomach fullness diet or the stomach hunger diet. I can only eat when I'm hungry now, and I have to stop when I'm full. Yeah. You know, we're talking about reconnecting with those signals for those who could. There are some people who aren't able to. For people who've experienced trauma may have a harder time, people who are on certain medications, people who are neurodivergent. There are reasons some people may not be able to actively connect. And we address that in the workbook. We address it even deeper in Beyond a Shadow of Diet. But the other thing I think it might get to is the part of a person who feels scared. Like when you know, diet culture teaches you can't trust yourself, right? I mean, that's the message. Yeah. You cannot trust yourself. And then what happens, actually, this is what I'm just writing about in the newsletter that's going to go out later this week, I think, is that, you know, so you can't trust yourself with sweets, so you keep them out of the house. Yes. That builds the deprivation. So when they're there, they glitter. That's the term I usually use. They glitter. And you want them. And so when you eat them, you find yourself eating them in a way that feels bad. It feels it's out of control. And so it proves to you, see, I can't be trusted with these foods. Mm-hmm. I have to get rid of them again. And you keep reinforcing that cycle versus, you know, and again, it's different for everybody how they do it, beginning to habituate to the foods, beginning to bring them in a way and with permission to eat them and promising yourself that you're not going to take them away again for the purposes of weight loss. Mm-hmm. But that's scary, right? I mean, that's understandably mm-hmm. scary. So it's understandable why it feels protective to start to try to make rules again, mm-hmm. even though in the long run, the rules don't serve you. And sometimes I think because of that, whether it's using, you know, many of the books out there, a workbook, but if people are still struggling on their own, getting guidance from somebody who is trained in the non-diet approach, whether it's a dietitian or a therapist, getting that support, if you have access to it, can be so important. There's mm-hmm. so many layers, right? So many layers.
But I'm so glad you guys wrote the workbook, because I think there are people who, for many, many reasons, don't have access to care initially, or maybe this can be a starting point for them to realize, hey, maybe I do want to go get support or care or pursue treatment further.
That's what we hope, that this becomes really a life-changing resource. This, the kind of work that I do and you do, Christina, it is life-changing for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I can just speak personally, like treatment is life-changing. It can be life-saving, in fact. So I very much just appreciate that you are writing as a clinician, and personally, I'm very glad you're writing the books and getting them out there. So many people out there probably don't even know that they're struggling and that they do need help. Like you said, they probably think they're just failing.
They're blaming themselves. They don't have enough willpower.
Yeah.
And I want everybody out there listening to know this is not about willpower. It's just not. And so if you've been caught in that diet cycle where it works for a week, a month, a year, several years, and then you find it, quote, not working, It's not your fault. It's not. And the best thing you can do for yourself is to get off that cycle, to let go of a diet mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Really heal your relationship with food.
Yeah, well said. Well, thank you again for everything you've just said and shared, all the books you've written, all the trainings you're doing, and I know you're going to continue to do. So where can people find you? Where can they find your books, your workbook, your newsletter?
I suppose the easiest way is to go to my website, which is very simply judithmatz.com. That's where you can sign up for the newsletter and you can just click on books and there'll be links to all the books. And I think in your notes, you'll have the resources listed. So they're all available on Amazon and at other booksellers. Perhaps we could put a link into the trainings. There's always a digital version. So that's always available. It'll get people to where they need to if they want to attend a live one. You can find me on Instagram at Jude Matz, JudMatz. Nice. We have a Diet Survivors Facebook group, so you can find us there as well.
Fantastic. All right, Judith, thank you so very much for your time and all you're doing. Like I said, really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you again for having me as a guest today.
Thank you.
This podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regards to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither the host, the publisher, or the guest are rendering legal, accounting, clinical, or any other professional information. If you want a professional, you should find one.